day one going to the park, you're kind of told certain things, unwritten rules of working for the team.
If Dan Snyder is walking towards you, walk the other way.
You don't look at Mr. Snyder in the eyes. You never call him Dan.
Was the worst environment I ever worked at for women.
He's 100% responsible. He should be owning all of this behavior that happened there because it's his team.
In the two decades that Dan Snyder has owned the Washington football team, the failures on the field have been well documented. But behind the scenes, a much more disturbing story has allegedly played out with a toxic workplace culture that, according to former employees, was plagued by harassment and fear. Today, ESPN's Jeremy Schapp brings us the stories of four women who worked for the team and who are now speaking out about an organization that they say tolerated sexism and harassment towards its female employees. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, September 3rd. This is ESPN Daily. Jeremy Schapp, thank you for joining me on ESPN Daily.
My pleasure, Pablo.
So I wanted to talk to you today about a team that's been in the news a lot lately, and not for the reasons anyone might actually want to be in the news. The Washington football team, which dropped their previous name this summer after years of public protests, is now facing new allegations regarding the culture within the team's front office. So how would you describe what's been reported about this team in recent weeks?
Well, these are devastating exposés that we've seen in the Washington Post, two of them specifically. The first one, which was published in July, allegations from 15 women who had worked in the organization about sexual harassment in the workplace, mistreatment, all kinds of egregious behavior. And then in the wake of that initial report, the Post reporters who had broken that story, they were contacted, I should say, by many more women specifically who had worked in the organization, who then came forward themselves. So now we're talking about 40 women speaking to the Washington Post about a culture that they described as misogynistic, as frightening, a culture in which they felt that they were subjected to near constant harassment.
This week, Jeremy, you were able to interview four of those dozens of women who came forward in the latest Post story for an Outside the Lines report that's airing today. What did they tell you?
The four women I spoke with talked about this culture in which they say they were harassed. They were subjected to misogynistic and sexist behavior. It was not infrequent to hear comments about the way they looked. And it's not just about the behavior of so many individuals in the organization, which can only be described as egregious or worse. It's about the fact that they felt they had nowhere to turn. There was one human resources person. The human resources department of this team was a single person. They felt powerless when this was happening to them.
One of the women you spoke to is named Rachel Engelson. And I'm curious, how would you describe her background?
Rachel Engelson is someone who grew up in the area. She's someone who attended the nearby University of Maryland. She's someone, when she got out of school, immediately went to work in the sports industry. And this was, as it is for so many people who land a job with an NFL franchise working in the league, this seemed to be a dream opportunity. And she worked there for 8 years, rising from an internship to a high-level position in the organization. And she says for years she was subjected to mistreatment from people high up in the organization.
It's hard working there. Like, you just know that depending on the certain way that you dress, that there's going to be comments made about what you're wearing. how you look. It's when you walk through the office, sometimes it's you just kind of are waiting for the comments to come from male colleagues. You know, I would get inappropriate comments about my hair, my outfit, how I looked in public in front of my own clients.
How did your experience compare to the experiences of other women working in the organization?
I'd say very similar. It, in a way, became a running joke and a rite of passage. If it didn't happen to you, then you maybe were only there for a week. I don't know. But it was just kind of like, here we go again. Like, of course that person said that. They always say that to every single female employee.
So in 2018, the team hires a new COO, Brian LaFemina, who'd previously worked at the NFL League office. How was he initially received?
There was a lot of hope that Brian LaFemina would help change the culture, that all of this misbehavior, all of this misogyny would finally be addressed by someone with power in the organization who was not brought up in this culture, in this corporate culture. And certainly that was the hope of Rachel Engelson.
I actually had a sit down with two of his executives and had a sit down meeting in their office to tell them, here's how this organization treats women, and I think you should know.
What was their reaction?
I can't really say much because I was, you know, looking at the ground the entire time, trying to recount everything that happened to me that they needed to know, and really putting myself out there to two people that I had to put my complete trust in that they would take me seriously and believe me. But they were, you know, very upset. They were horrified. And they tried their best to assure me that that's not how things are. That's not how things are and how they're operated elsewhere.
Not long after that meeting, Rachel says she got a call from Brian LaFemina and the team's chief counsel saying they were going to work on these issues. They hired an outside human resources firm to come in to conduct training. They did one session of this HR training, and then Brian LaFemina is fired. He was on the job for just 8 months.
After he was fired, there was a meeting that was held, a hastily held meeting with the marketing and sponsorship team, kind of saying, we're going to go back to how things were. And I was not okay with that. So I actually resigned from the team without having a job because I did not want to be working there anymore.
So Rachel Engelson is just one woman's story, but what did you learn about how pervasive the kind of behavior Rachel describes was throughout the organization?
Well, one of the other women I spoke to, her name is Alicia Klein, and she said many of the same things about the culture and the environment with the team. She worked as an intern in 2010. She was 27 years old. She was earning her master's degree in sports management at Georgetown. She came to the U.S. from Brazil, her native country. That's where she lives now. I spoke to her via Zoom from Brasilia, the capital where she lives, a few days ago. She was working in the team's marketing department a decade ago.
In other places where I worked, I could tell the sexual harassment was about the individuals. At the Washington football team, I felt like it was institutionalized. The ownership or the leadership of the company, I don't think they respect women. And I don't think they saw it as a problem.
If someone had come to you at some point in the last decade, a woman, and said, I'm thinking about going to work for the Washington football team, what would have been your advice?
Don't. It's not a good place. It's not a good place to work, and it's not a good place for women. I was followed to my car by a player who I kept saying, I don't want to go out with you. I don't want to go out. Just please just leave me alone. And he'd follow me to my car. These guys are huge. They're massive. And, you know, how am I supposed to feel safe and do my job if I know that somebody's going to be, you know, waiting for me in the parking lot? And I have my colleagues telling me, oh, you know, just wait, you know, in a, you know, a couple of days they'll get tired and they'll go chase somebody else. How is that acceptable?
One of the more disturbing things to come out of the latest Washington Post report was this allegation that multiple videos had been created using footage from photo shoots with the team's cheerleaders. What was on these videos?
These are videos that were described to the Post as the lewd outtakes from cheerleader calendar shoots that took place in 2008 and 2010. And they include moments in which the cheerleaders are changing their clothes, graphic close-ups of their private parts, inappropriate material. One of the women we interviewed this week, Pablo, Megan Imbert, she worked for the team's internal video production unit at the time these videos apparently were made.
I remember walking into the editing bay, and this might have been after practice, and going to put a tape in. There was already a tape in the playback machine, and when I turned it on, I remember seeing footage of, you know, a bikini bottom area that was zoomed in, and it wouldn't have been something I wanted to be shown, right? And I remember seeing that, but no context to it. It wasn't in an actual clip. It was a piece of footage. I just found it to be odd that I saw it there. So it's just one of those things I kind of tucked away in the back of my head, just thinking, I just really hope nothing ever comes of something like that.
Megan says she never spoke to anyone about what she saw in the edit room at the time. But after the big story in the Post in July, she has a conversation with a former colleague from the production department named Brad Baker.
I asked Brad, did you ever have to do anything inappropriate with footage of these cheerleaders? And I mean, within 5 minutes, he was like, yeah. I was furious at that moment. That's when I told the Post, put me on record, put my face to it. This is disgusting. Not only about my experience, I just, like, I'm about to cry right now. Like, I can't even imagine what those cheerleaders are feeling. I've talked to a few of them, and it's traumatizing. It's devastating. This is not something they would have consented to. So when I learned of that, it's absolutely maddening. And there's no way I wasn't going to speak out about this.
So Brad Baker declined our interview request, but he told the Washington Post that he was present at a meeting where Larry Michael, the team's longtime play-by-play radio announcer and until recently a senior vice president of the organization, asked for one of these videos to be made. He said, for owner Daniel Snyder. Now, both Michael and Snyder have vehemently denied this. Michael says he was never asked to do this, and he never asked anyone to create such a video. Snyder said he never requested any such videos and never saw any such videos. I should add, Pablo, that ESPN and me personally, we haven't seen these videos. The Washington Post says they have copies of them and that they invited the team to watch them. The team declined, saying it wanted the Post to provide them with the videos so they could try to authenticate them. The Post, for its part, put the tapes through some kind of forensic analysis, and those who analyzed it say they do not appear to have been manipulated.
One of the cheerleaders, Jeremy, reportedly featured in one of those videos is a woman named Tiffany Scorby. You ended up talking to her as well. What is her background?
Tiffany Scorby is someone who's very passionate about cheerleading. She was a cheerleader at Georgetown University. She spent 7 years as a cheerleader with the Washington football team. These cheerleaders, with this team and with most teams, they're not paid very much money, and it's hard work. One of the perks of the job, though, was going on these calendar shoots, you know, in tropical destinations. And it was something Tiffany described as something she loved being a part of.
The calendar trip is one of the most exciting experiences. You know, Sports Illustrated types of shots with Sports Illustrated level photographers. And we were really excited about that and felt we were in a protected space. I remember being just in a really beautiful setting with what I thought were professionals. Many of them were, to be clear. But I was topless, and there are moments where I had to strategically move myself around to, have as much of an appropriate shot as possible, understanding it was still going to be photoshopped and edited. And I've seen, to be clear, I'm one of a few people that have actually seen the videos that were released to the post. I believe I was probably the most exposed throughout both videos. That doesn't mean anything. No one should be in any of those videos. Watching the videos was, I just went blacked out. I blacked out. It's like, what is this with this like sexual music in the background? And it was literally, I blacked out. I couldn't watch the 2010 video all the way through. This is not how my sisters wanted to be portrayed, and certainly did not know that they were.
Coming up. Jeremy, let's talk specifically about the team's owner and what these women had to say about how much responsibility he bears for the organization's culture.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Jeremy, when stories of workplace abuse like this are reported, the natural next step is to figure out who gets held accountable. And the search here has begun at the very top of the organization, with the owner of the Washington football team, Daniel Snyder. What did these women say about Snyder's presence in the workplace?
What they said, Pablo, is that they were told by colleagues, basically from day one, to avoid Dan Snyder. One of the women I spoke to who worked for the team, Rachel Engelson, she described it this way.
So when you first start with the team, it depends who you know, who was your boss. But day one, going to the park, you're kind of told certain things. You dress a certain way. You got to enter a certain way. If Mr. Snyder is there, don't walk past him. Don't look him in the eye. Don't use a specific entrance if his car is over parked by a back door. Just certain things that kind of at the outset you were told immediately before going. And it wasn't necessarily from HR. It was unwritten rules of working for the team.
You didn't want to run into the boss. You didn't want to displease the boss if you happened to interact with him. It was one of these unwritten rules around the organization. And then there were quirky things about the way he wanted things done, which his executive assistants told the Washington Post about paper clips facing the same direction, and having to go fetch his ice from a basement ice maker, not the one in the closer kitchen. The women described basically an environment, a culture of fear. And it certainly seems from their perspective that this atmosphere, this fear was pervasive.
So, Jeremy, was Snyder ever involved in a specific questionable incident himself?
There is one specific allegation about a personal direct interaction with Dan Snyder. And Tiffany Scorby told this to the Post, and she told it to us. And it's about an incident, she says, that took place in 2004 at Fight Night, a big charity event at the Washington Hilton Hotel. The Washington football team cheerleaders were performing. Dan Snyder was there. And also there was Dr. Anthony Roberts, who is an old friend of Dan Snyder's from growing up in Maryland. And he also happens to be, coincidentally, an ophthalmologist who had performed LASIK surgery on Tiffany Scorby the previous year.
I remember that night very, very well. We were at Fight Night, and just like always, we're encouraged just to walk around Dan. And we were excited. We enjoy Fight Night. We get to dance in a room or in the ring, and we're all together, and it's great. It's a lot of fun. We got off from dancing in the ring, and we were walking around, and unfortunately, I got in Dan's line of sight. So I'm a pretty confident person, but very, very kind of meekly, I put my head down and wanted to walk away in the other direction. And he called my name, which was pretty astounding and a bit concerning. And of course, he's my employer. So I walked over there and started to, you know, have some small conversation with him. He was very socially awkward. I was, you know, asking, oh, are you enjoying yourself? Just any small talk, because he again, wasn't really listening to me. He was kind of looking through me and cut me off and said, you know, Tony's here. I had no idea who Tony was. I always refer to him as Dr. Anthony Roberts or Dr. Anthony. And so, okay, there's a lot of people there. And he said, you know, we have a hotel room. Why don't you go upstairs and get to know one another better? And I was trying to process if I heard him correctly. Sure enough, he was being very serious. And I just walked away. I said, I'm sorry, I have to work. Have a great evening. I reported it to my director that night. My director, who had spent literally decade plus protecting the Washington Redskins cheerleaders, had no one to tell because all of his bosses and directors and managers were sitting around the table with Mr. Snyder. And we just, that was the mentality. There was no one to go to.
Jeremy, what has Dan Snyder said about this specific allegation that back in 2004 at this Fight Night event, he had suggested Tiffany Scorby join his friend, Dr. Anthony Roberts, in a hotel room so they could, quote, get to know each other a little better?
Adamant denial, total, complete, blanket denial. I don't remember. It's this never took place. Tiffany says she's still associated with the team, still working with the cheerleaders, a sideline assistant for the cheerleading squad. And she told me that Dan Snyder's denial was particularly disturbing to her.
He can deny it all day long, but I have no motivation to make this up. He has a lot of motivation to make this up. I don't. So I'm fine to go toe-to-toe with him on it because I know people say it's he said, she said. She said it because it happened.
Jeremy, Dan Snyder has completely overhauled the executive leadership structure within the organization since these allegations came to light. Several staffers have been fired. Larry Michael announced his sudden retirement. And Snyder hired former NFL player and former partner at McKinsey, Jason Wright, as the new team president, making him the first Black team president in the history of the entire NFL. Snyder also hired a former sports broadcaster, Julie Donaldson, as the new senior vice president of media, which makes her the highest ranking woman within the organization. Snyder released a statement about all of this organizational shuffling, and he said, quote, I have admittedly been too hands-off as an owner and have allowed others to have day-to-day control to the detriment of our organization. Going forward, I'm going to be more involved. And we have already made major changes in personnel, bringing in new leadership to drive the cultural transformation on and off the field, end quote. even with these changes, Jeremy, how much responsibility do the women think rests with Dan Snyder for the organization's failures over these past 20 years?
Pablo, the women I spoke to put a lot of the blame at Dan Snyder's feet. They do not buy at all what he was trying to sell in that statement, that he has been too hands-off. That was something Rachel Engelson felt very strongly about.
He's 100% responsible. 100%. He should be owning all of this behavior that happened there because it's his team. And I don't buy the, I wasn't involved enough. I do not buy that.
Rachel, he recently said that these are old allegations. They don't represent what the team's culture like is today. You were working there relatively recently. How do you respond to that statement, that defense?
Honestly, to me, it was a slap in the face. It completely ignored my entire experience because he's saying that this happened more than 10 years ago and I just left the team a year and a half ago. So it's that response to me was not okay. That was not someone who's willing to take responsibility. It was an attack on every one of us who had the guts and the courage to come forward.
We learned this week that the NFL League Office, Jeremy, is now taking over the investigations of these allegations. The team has said it will allow all employees, past and present, to cooperate with this investigation. So what are the stakes for Dan Snyder with respect to what the league may end up finding here?
It's hard to say. You would have to imagine, Pablo, that if the law firm that is investigating these allegations concludes that they are true, if somehow they are able to verify to their own satisfaction and to the satisfaction of the National Football League the veracity of these allegations, some more than others, that would put Dan Snyder in a position of perhaps being removed as the team owner, of being forced out at the very least. Really, for decades, the franchise has found ways to embarrass itself. And there is the on-the-field component. There was the name, which Dan Snyder was so reluctant to change for so long and only did so finally under duress from financial partners. And then there is this. There are the allegations in the Washington Post that we've seen over the course of the last month and a half about such egregious behavior. I would have to think that this is the kind of misbehavior, if verified, that would rise to the level of having to figure out a way to remove Dan Snyder.
Jeremy Schapp, thank you for joining us, and thank you for following up on this story.
Thank you, Pablo. Thank you for doing the show. And really, the reporting done here by the Washington Post has been so impactful.
Coming up, 92-year-old Vin Scully has joined Twitter. So I asked my favorite Luddite to pardon the interruption and weigh in.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Here's another story I want you to know. Vin Scully, the forever voice of the Dodgers, published his very first tweet yesterday, uploading a video at the ripe age of 92.
This is Vin making his debut on social media, and it's nice to be welcomed. We might chat about a famous date in baseball, or a player, or a team, and hopefully nothing controversial. This is strictly a meeting of friends.
Scully told Bill Plaschke that he's joining Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook because he misses the fans, having retired from the booth 4 years ago. And for the record, we miss Vin too. But it is precisely because I care about Vin Scully that I also need to warn him. Vin, Mr. Scully, stay away from here. Stay far away and never return. I am on Twitter all the time. I'm memeing, lurking, developing carpal tunnel in both wrists. This is a sick, sad world. But don't just take my obviously hypocritical advice here. I recruited my favorite blue check rejector and Luddite, Tony Kornheiser, to weigh in. And Tony left me a voicemail because, of course he did, with his thoughts.
Hey, so I saw where Vin Scully at 92 was going to go on Twitter. I guess that reduces the amount of people who are not on Twitter now to just me. Yeah, I'm not on Twitter, as you know. I'm not on the Facebook, as you know. I don't subscribe to the Hulu. I'm not, as Bill Belichick would say, on InstaFace. Yeah, I don't do that. I don't see any need to do that. You know, I read newspapers. I watch television. I don't really need to have everybody screaming at me on Twitter. I'm old enough so that I listened to Vin Scully when he was in New York. Okay, before he went to L.A., and he went to L.A., I assume, in 1957 or 1958. And I'm old enough to have listened to him in New York before that, which makes me, when dog years, about 73,000 years old. It's possible I would go on Twitter if I reach Vin's age. Maybe I'll go on Twitter then, and then I would be boisterous. God, I would be boisterous on Twitter because who's kidding who? If you're going to go on, you may as well go on, right?
Right. You know, it doesn't sound like 92-year-old Tony Kornheiser is here to make friends. I'm at Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.